Welcome to the Bike Show on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. It's November, the clocks have gone back, the evenings are dark, and the weather is cold. It's a time that we endure cycling as much as we enjoy it. But the winter is a great time to start thinking about the bike rides that we want to do next year, once the sun starts shining again. How about 20,000 miles across Africa? Well, that's a ride that Pete Gostolo recently made over a couple of years. He's returned back to the UK. We went for a short evening jaunt in London, and we started our journey at that haven of happy cycling, the Elephant and Castle roundabout.
Having cycled across Africa, I don't know whether you came across any roundabouts that are as chaotic and hostile as this one.
Yeah, well, I've been through quite a few cities. I mean, Africa actually, well, it's like most cities in, I suppose, poorer parts of the world. There's no traffic lights, and well, the traffic, it's a free-for-all. Less cyclists on the road. More people on the road, and the roadside would be built up with markets, and actually a bit more chaotic. Here, it is sort of chaotic, but there's a little bit of orderliness to it. Most motorists sort of follow the traffic rules here. So
we're going to ride west towards Battersea, which is your destination this evening, on your way back home to Dorset. So just a couple of miles, a short journey in rush hour London, and we'll have a chat about your African journey. And just before we go, let's have a look at the bike you've got here. It looks well used, as you'd expect, and quite dusty. Is that red African dust?
I'd love to say it was red African dust. There probably is, if you take the bike apart, a fair bit of African dust embedded within parts of the bike, but most of this is more recent, the last month or two. But actually, I haven't done much off-road riding in the UK because there's a lot of good on-road riding. But yeah, the bike's been fully tested. It's had a few changes since I came back, just simple things like gear cable and brake cables and new tyres, but other than that, it's the original frame and the original gear set, and as you can see, the saddle is quite well broken in.
Yeah, look, it looks like it's a Brook saddle like mine, but yeah, significantly more broken in than mine.
Looked after, perhaps. I tended to be lazy when it rained, sort of forgot to put a waterproof cover on it, so it's definitely been quite well weather beaten.
But it's the full-on expedition bicycle. It's a Thorn Raven Tour with the roll-off hub gear at the back, and massive, strong, beefy panniers front and back, and lots of sort of water bottle cages all over the place.
Yeah, it's a few modifications, but these bikes they're set up really for long distance touring. So most people have got the front and the rear racks on and a few extra bottle cages. And then you're pretty much set to go. I mean, a bicycle is a great mode of transport because of its simplicity. And the gear system, well, that's perhaps the most complicated part on it, but it's been built so solidly that I've had no major problems with it. The wheels are very strong, the spokes. And if you look after your bike, well, generally it's going to serve you well for a number of years. And this has probably still got another big journey in it, should I choose to start another one. Yeah.
So where did your impulse come from to make these big journeys? Have you always been a touring cyclist and you sort of worked your way up and one thing led to another? You had some sort of entry level drug of a sort of ramble around the Dorset countryside, and then, you know, you did a coast to coast, and then maybe a Land's End to John O'Groats, and one thing led to another? Or did you just think, man, it's got to be the bicycle?
No, I mean, I think I got on the bike through backpacking initially. I mean, sitting on buses and trains and looking out of windows and feeling a bit disconnected from the countries I was going through, and I met a few people who were traveling on a bicycle. This is about 7 or 8 years ago in parts of Turkey at the time, and the stories they had and the experience, it got me thinking. And then I read some literature, Devlin Murphy and Anne Musto, and it was around about the time where people started keeping blogs and websites, and there was a fair bit of information out there about cycle touring and the stories that people had of cycling in far-flung destinations. It got me thinking, and then I found myself out in Japan. I was teaching English, living there for a few years. I had a different bike at the time, but I used it over the weekends and long holidays, and I discovered quite quickly that, you know, the bicycle was probably one of the best means to explore a new place. And then from that, it was just more planning and saving and researching and then getting out on the road and making a big journey, really. And I've always stayed on the bicycle because I think it's a great way to see a new place.
And did it feel a bit scary if you weren't really immersed in the ways of the bicycle, sort of setting out with a really long journey, because you decided to ride back from Japan, right?
Right, that was the first journey. Well, I could mend a puncture, but other than that, you know, there was something complicated that broke. I sort of went out more optimistic, hoping that things wouldn't suddenly break, and I'd listen to the bike, and if there was a strange noise coming, then it would probably be a sign of something finishing its life. But I mean, you learn from your mistakes, so you learn when things break. You know, if I was to ride around the world on a motorbike, you know, I'd be much more daunted by it, because if I broke down in the middle of nowhere, I might not be able to put it back together and get back on the road. So you learn slowly. Most of the bike is pretty familiar to me now. And, well, yeah, lots of places in the world, there's always somebody who's going to help you in some format or another.
Yeah. I mean, did you find that being on the bicycle changed the way in which people related to you as a traveller?
Absolutely. I mean, travelling by bicycle, the beauty of it is you're moving slowly, so you're interacting with people. You can hear them, you can see them before you get to them. You're moving slowly, you're able to greet people. And, you know, the bicycle is such a non-threatening mode of transport that in certain places in the world where most people wouldn't associate a foreigner travelling on a bicycle, you end up drawing sympathy from people, because you're sort of rolling into a village or a small town, pouring with sweat. And you sort of slow down, and it's always a talking point. People are curious to know why are you traveling on a bicycle as opposed to being in something that you could probably afford to travel in anyway. So the bike is a great talking point, and as I say, it's non-threatening, and it always opens up conversation in all different sort of manners or formats from people from all different walks of life. So that's the other beauty of it, I think.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could say the same about cycling around London.
London, yeah.
I don't think the bicycle breaks down barriers in that same way.
No, I'm not sure it does. I feel that cycling around London, if you can cycle confidently around London, then you could probably tackle quite a few other cities in the world. Because it is actually quite threatening. I mean, people are always in a rush to get to places, and cyclists included. So there's no stopping on the roadside and asking. Well, you can ask people for directions, but more often than not, people are in a rush to get to places. So, yeah, it's not quite like stopping on the roadside in, Kampala or Kigali or somewhere like that. Yeah.
Let's get on the road. Well, here we are in four lanes of motor traffic, bus to the left, lone cyclist ahead, taxis, minicabs, all kinds of vehicles. Oh, and we're off. Well, we've safely negotiated the Elephant and Castle double roundabout, and now we're heading into the back streets of Woolworth, past the Hampton Court Palace pub, and I'm going to take you to see the 56A bike space, which has been featured previously on the radio show. Going this way, yeah. It's a place where people can come and fix their bikes. So yeah, this is the 56A bike space. Fantastic. And it's a place where people can come and fix their bikes. There's some tools there and there's some knowledge amongst the volunteers who help.
I didn't even know that something like this existed around here. I thought you'd have to take your bike to a shop and leave it and then come back later and find out that you're going to have to pay quite a lot of money to have some guy service it.
Well, you can do that as well.
You can do that as well, but it's much better that you know how to fix your bike yourself. This actually reminds me a little bit of sort of back streets in Africa, the fact that there's all these old frames here and tools around the place and sort of a community almost, actually.
Yeah, people. Because there's a lot of cleverness going on in terms of, you know, there's big barrels of chain sets and pedals, and it's about mixing and matching old used parts and getting them working.
And it, I mean, how's this set up? Is it a sort of voluntary run thing? Do you have to be a member or something?
No, it's a voluntary run thing. It's there's a food co-op here which is open. I don't know if the food co-op's open. Go and have a look. Their door's open. No, food co-op is not open right now because that's open three evenings a week, and they have rice and grains and vegetables and things like that. And then there's a kind of anarchist info shop, which is sort of books and pamphlets and things like that. I was wondering what kind of thing you'd experienced in terms of people fixing bikes and making their own bikes in Africa. Because the bicycle is quite a crucial mode of transport in that continent, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the other great thing about cycling in Africa is there are a lot of people who are riding bicycles, and it's less about a sort of recreation as more of a form of necessity, because, you know, the bicycle exists for people who don't have money to afford a motor car or a motorbike, and that's generally the majority of people. So a bicycle is critical, and, you know, the bikes there, they vary tremendously. Your standard African bike would be a Chinese or Indian imported steel frame, a sort of Hercules or a Flying Pigeon, which you'd see quite a lot of. And these things can, you know, withstand carrying a lot of weight, which a lot of bikes there do. But then I think in more recent years, there are a number of charities which have sort of donated bikes. So you see all sorts of secondhand bikes, mountain bikes, even BMXs, which is great. But one of the problems, in fact, is that you know, you've got a bike with a derailleur system, and people there don't actually know how to fix them. So you would see a lot of small shops, not even shops, but sort of market stalls, where there would be old frames and parts, and there'd be a couple of guys there who would be, you know, maintaining and fixing people's bicycles. And that's throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Yep, see it everywhere.
Now here we are in Kennington Park. A little bit of greenery, a bit of peace. Quite nice here. We've just ridden over a sign that says no cycling, so we have to be very solicitous to all the people who are walking.
Yeah, no, I don't really pay too much attention to that, although occasionally that bell, sometimes you get, you know, odd looks when people turn around and say this is my right of way. But
yeah, I don't know, I don't really like using such a kind of assertive bell. I quite like the sort of the tring tring type of bell. But what I've recently discovered since I've been riding with this bike, which has got a Campagnolo freewheel, actually it makes quite a nice classic bicycle freewheel sound, which sort of announces your arrival but without scaring the life out of anybody.
I was riding off-road yesterday up along the coast from Scarborough to Robin Hood's Bay, and my friend, because it was off-road, he was on a mountain bike. He didn't have a bell, so every time he needed to get people off the track, he'd just pull a skid behind them. And the sound of that is actually a bit more frightening than a bell. As if somebody's approaching at full speed and has to slam the fingers on the brakes, and it seemed to work quite effectively, and then he'd just sort of apologise and laugh afterwards. But yeah, no, I think cycling generally around these parks is great. I mean, people keep to one side and cyclists keep to another, but I don't know London well enough to know if you can get in trouble for sort of cycling in parks where there's no, it says no cycling.
I think there's been a bit of a clamp down in the Royal Parks,
right.
And I think you can get a kind of instant fixed penalty ticket there, although that's never happened to me. But I gather that can happen. But in the Royal Parks, there tend to be sort of bicycle thoroughfares, which is, you know, you stick to that and that's fine. And that's actually a reasonable policy, to have a couple of direct routes, a north-south and an east-west, and then just say everything else is for people who are walking.
Yeah, no, I think the more cyclists there are, the better. But of course, I'd always say that.
So let's talk a little bit about why you wanted to ride across Africa. You obviously done a big bike ride, and that was from Japan back to the UK, presumably. Sort of, was it through China and Central Asia?
China and Southeast Asia, India, Central Asia, the Middle East, and even that trip went across North Africa. No, I mean, my first big journey out of Europe after university was in Africa. It was sort of backpacking around Southern Africa. And I'd always been interested in the continent, you know, from reading stories of adventure in the Congo and anything like that. And I'd always look at Africa and think of all the countries I knew very little bit about. And so once I got into cycle touring and saw it as a great way to explore the world, I always wanted to go back to Africa. And I couldn't see a better way of traveling north to south in Africa than being on the bicycle. So even though I'd made the big journey across Asia for some years before, I was even thinking about doing a journey by bicycle through Africa, and it was just a sort of logical progression after doing that big trip that I'd take off and do another one.
You said there that you're going from north to south across Africa, and actually, having looked at your route on your website, that is not a really accurate description of your route. You're actually doing a kind of crazy S shape where you don't actually have any north-south at all. You're kind of going across, then back across, then back across.
It was really like the Congo River. It meandered around and across like a giant snake. No, it was north to south, but I wanted to incorporate as much of it as possible. And I was interested in West Africa, and I was interested in Central Africa. I was particularly interested in the countries that most people really hadn't been to in recent years, like the Congo. You know, I had two routes in mind. One was to stick along the west coast, which would have taken me from Cameroon, which is where I actually left the west coast of Africa, and I would have continued south through.
So you began on the Atlantic coast of Morocco, right?
Yeah, that's right. I began in Morocco, and then I followed the coast down. I mean, I followed all the countries which border the sea, all the way down to Cameroon, which takes in about 12 countries. But from Cameroon,
you presumably weren't just riding along one long beachfront promenade.
No. I mean, I did actually ride along the beach. I crossed the border from the Ivory Coast into Ghana on the beach, and I could see a little flag waving out from a palm tree. That was the border. But most of that ride, it's not a coastal ride at all. You know, you might be more like 50, 100 kilometers from the actual coast itself. And I went inland and I zigzagged through different countries. But from Cameroon on the Atlantic coast, that's when I basically turned and headed east, and I went through the Central African Republic into Congo DRC, which, you know, very few people have done by any form of vehicle, at least within the last 20 years.
Yeah, because people do talk about this band of inaccessibility of Sudan, Congo, and then Angola, of very difficult places where there isn't really a functioning government, there isn't security, they maybe have wars of one kind or another or insurgencies, and it's a risky place to go as an outsider.
Yeah, I mean, generally those countries in Central Africa, they're still quite unstable. There's no infrastructure which is set up at the moment for, you know, anybody who's wishing to make an overland journey through Africa, unless you're very adventurous. And I was interested in the Congo, full stop, and I wanted to go through it. And most of the people who'd given me information had said it was too dangerous. Of course, it's an enormous country. And the information, well, when you get information about anything, it depends who you ask. And, you know, I asked more people. And I suppose in hindsight, I did have some fortune that nothing particularly bad happened to me in the Congo or the Central African Republic, other than the obvious sort of police checkposts which you encounter in Africa. It was a tremendous experience. I mean, it was the height of the adventure, and I wanted to go through it, and I did, and I used the river as a major means of transport.
Because I was going to ask you, I mean, this is probably betraying terrible ignorance on my part, but do they even have roads in these places, or is the transport by river and that kind of thing?
It's interesting. I mean, well, speaking about the Congo, you know, 60 years ago when the Belgians were there, they developed a tremendous road network system. I mean, if you look at an old colonial map, you'll see the road and the rail network, which was developed to basically pillage the country. You know, they built it for their own means. So probably up until the 70s, when things started to fall apart, there was quite a good infrastructure there. But, you know, the last 20 years or so, those roads through the jungle haven't been maintained, so the jungle has taken them over. And, you know, I'd be cycling along tracks which once would have been a major thoroughfare, but all of a sudden, you know, that the jungle would just envelop the road, and you would cycle through a tunnel sometimes which might only be a meter wide, and all of a sudden you could see you were going to cross a river on the map. You know, and that river, there'd be a huge old iron bridge over it, and there might be a rusted sort of vehicle, you know, in the bush on the side. So there are tracks through the jungle. And what's great, again, is that really the best means of traveling through that country is on a bicycle, because, you know, if there's a broken bridge, well, you know, on a bicycle, you can effectively carry your bike across it. You'd have to build a bridge if you were going in motorized transport. And most Congolese, they're transporting goods through the jungle, you know, by bicycle. They'll have these Chinese bikes, and they'll load them up with petrol on the back, or salt, or any commodity, and they'll push their bike through the bush for days to get to the town with the market where they're going to sell it. So, you know, on a bicycle, I had the flexibility to go down any of these tracks, and most of it, well, all of it was off-road, but, you know, the terrain would vary from sort of compact red earth to sort of slightly sandy or broken road. So, it was possible to go through it, and it got me into East Africa. And from there, I was heading back south again through countries I was interested in going through, such as Tanzania and Mozambique and Malawi, and then actually coming back across the continent back to West Africa, because I was interested in Namibia. I'd always wanted to go to Namibia, and to get there, well, I was coming back through from Malawi into Zimbabwe, Victoria Falls, and into Namibia. So yeah, if you look at the map of Africa, my route in a simple form sort of resembles an S. Is it an S, or it's a
yeah,
snake?
I think it's
anyway.
An S. Yeah. I mean, did you have trouble finding accurate maps for some of these places, or was it a question of there's no use using a map, I'm just going to ask people and get pointed in the right direction and hope for the best?
No, I love maps. I mean, you know, these days, not so much for Africa, but many other places, you can get quite good maps and download them and put them on your GPS. But I always loved looking at paper maps. So I set off with, there's a couple of reasonable maps for Africa, Michelin maps, which cover west cover the whole continent, but they don't often have quite enough detail, particularly on a bicycle, so I would search out for country maps. Some of those maps are better than others, but, you know, I always loved having at least one map per country, and then, you know, included with that, you know, I would ask people about roads and distances. Half the time the information might be wrong. It was always going to be part of the adventure, but I couldn't have imagined traveling through the continent without a map. You know, part of the enjoyment was to be able to visually look down and see the places I was going through at different scales, whether it just be a country scale or a sort of region of Africa. So, you know, I've got a collection of probably 24 African maps, and I managed to sort of keep them. I didn't keep them in my panniers the whole journey. There were several times through the trip where I was able to send them back. But it's great to have those maps because, you know, I like looking at the places I went through and the names of places, and it brings back memories, of course.
Yeah. And does that mean that you were riding on fairly major significant roads? Or are there no major significant roads in some places?
Well, the truth is now you could almost ride from the north of Africa right to the south and be on paved roads all the way. You know, that's mostly going through East Africa. But I wasn't so interested in that for different reasons. You know, one of them is that, you know, some of the roads would be quite busy with trucks. They're major, you know, arteries of transport. And I was always interested, just as I was in my first trip, in looking at a map and seeing, you know, on a country map you'd have red roads, and those red roads would be the highways, and sometimes those highways could be quite empty, but other times they could be tremendously busy and dangerous. And then below the red roads you had the secondary roads, which were the yellow roads on the map, and then below that you'd have, you know, which were the minor roads, the white roads. And I always loved just plotting a route which incorporated those white roads, and they would go through villages where, of course, very few people would have come through before on a bicycle or any kind of vehicle. These were roads which there is no public transport along them, so of course the people you meet along those roads, they're amazed to see you come through. You're arriving totally unannounced, and I got met in the majority of circumstances, particularly in rural Africa, with tremendous hospitality by people in those places, and it was great to be able to experience that and then write about it and sort of tell people that, you know, Africa wasn't this big, dark, dangerous place. The problems I did have in Africa, which anybody who followed my journey would know about, you know, always took place in urban places, which you could probably say the world over anyway. So I actually felt safer, and I preferred being really out in the wild because I could go into a small village and I knew that when I stopped, people would come towards me and there'd be this curiosity. It wouldn't be this hostility that you might envisage from some crazy film like that. No, it was overwhelmingly positive.
Well, let's carry on. We've got fading light here, so I'm trying to get you to Battersea before it gets dark.
I was riding with Pete Gostolo, trans-African cyclist, and you can listen to the rest of our ride next week on The Bike Show. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.